to staff.
Could we please have the roll call?
Certainly.
All right. Diane Furst.
Here.
Mary Beth Bushy.
Here.
Michael Borstein.
Here.
Thomas Gaffney.
Here.
Dan Hilmer.
Here.
And Dean Giovanni.
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up on the agenda is open time for public participation. This is a time for members of the public to speak on items not on tonight's agenda. We allow up to 2 minutes. Is there anybody who would like to speak? Nope. All right. Let's move on then. Next up, agenda item 8, revised general manager employment agreement. I guess I'll take this, or would you?
I think so.
Okay. We have met and performed an employment an employee evaluation, and have in front of us a revised employment agreement for the general manager. There have been a couple of changes. Number one, in Section 2, compensation, we will be there has been a proposal to change the monthly salary to 21863. And then, Dean, would you like to address the wording you would like to see changed on Section 7?
Yeah, a clarification for the deferred compensation contribution that CMSA shall contribute 4% of the manager's annual salary minus bonuses to the manager's 457 deferred compensation program. A statement, if you can put a statement in there regarding that this is in addition to the base monthly salary.
I will make that change. Exact change. This amount is
wording that the attorney deems appropriate.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
To address that issue.
Was there another edit you wanted to propose?
It was minor. I think based on the discussion that we had, I think item section 3 is fine with me.
Okay.
That was where I had it. But I think it's fine.
Okay. So. Is there any member of the public who would like to speak to this agenda item? See none, I will bring it back to the board for discussion and or a motion.
I'll move that we approve the revised general manager's employment agreement as amended.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposition? That's the unanimous.
Thank you.
Move on to agenda item 9, consent calendar. The consent calendar items are routine and will be enacted in one motion. Any member of the public, staff, or the board may remove an item to be discussed individually. Is there anybody who'd like to remove anything? All right, then I would entertain a motion to approve 9A through 9G.
I move we approve the consent calendar.
I'll second it.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposition? That's unanimous. Thank you. Let's move on to agenda item 10, Listec Biosolids reuse presentation.
Thank you, Chair Furst. So, as we've talked about many times in the past, CMSA has a long history of beneficially reusing our biosolids. And since I've been here, probably since 1993, and probably a few years before that, our primary practice has been that during the wet weather season, which is usually end of October through the end of April, we transport the dewatered biosolids to the railroad landfill where they use this alternate daily cover. So they're mixed with, you know, some bulking material, green waste, wood waste, spread over the landfill at the end of the day. Then during the dry weather season, which is usually end of April through end of October, they're transported to a land application site. You know, for the last 15 years, that's been a site in southern Sonoma County between Highway 37, Lakeville Highway, and Petaluma River, where there was a farm there. They were dumped, dried out, then spread across the farm, dissed in, and used as a fertilizer and soil amendment. And since probably the early 2000s, you know, we've been, you know, tracking on different, you know, limitations on biosolids land application throughout the state. And I reported that to the board, you know, several times over the last 15 years. And this has led the agency to look at different ways to manage our biosolids and diversify our reuse options. So that led to the agency participating in, like, the biosolids, or the BACL Biosolids Committee, the Biosolids Energy Coalition, which has done some really good work. And more recently, there's been two activities that we've diversified our biosolids. One is that in 2015, in the new contract with Synagro, which is a residual management company that manages several land application sites in the region, that we included the Solano County land application sites, which has a lower tipping fee also. And the reason we did that is because some large agencies started bringing their dewatered biosolids to the Sonoma County site, which has a limited capacity. And then when that started happening in 2014, that site closed down in September versus late October. So it was a prime opportunity to add some other land application sites to the contract. So we did that. And then more recently, we had discussions with Listec, which is a company that's from Canada, and now they have a presence in California, specifically in Fairfield, and they have a facility that receives biosolids and produces a biofertilizer. So we talked with them about that as being one of their first clients, in addition to Fairfield's Assumed Sewer District. Drafted up an agreement, brought that to the board, and the board approved that agreement back in September of last year, and that is for CMSA to transport the biosolids there, pay a certain tipping fee, and that we could deliver up to 6 loads per week to their facility. CMSA only produces 1, you know, 8, 16 to 20, you know, ton load a day. So when we started delivering biosolids there in October of last year, we had, you know, in our budget 2 loads per week. So that's what we've been doing last year and the current fiscal year. But we have the opportunity to send more there in the future. But with that background, I'd like to introduce Mr. Jim Dunbar, the general manager of the Listex California operation. Several staff and I just visited their facility a few weeks ago, had a great tour from Jim, and he's going to talk about the facility, and he offered to come in tonight and give you a presentation. And we said, great idea.
Great, thank you. So we have to look behind you for the presentation, but that's...
Does he have a little...
So this will be short. Feel free to ask any questions. Okay, thank you. So we call, and Jason was right, we are a Canadian company that's been in business for 17 years. We have up to 6 ongoing facilities in Canada. A couple years ago, we moved into California, established our presence. Since then, we've signed another agreement with a facility in St. Cloud, Minnesota, and 2 more in Canada. So it's been a pretty rapid growth of succession. So just noticed there was a date missed there, I think, without my glasses.
Oh, this is what you're going to have.
This one?
Yeah.
So this one? This one. We'll try.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This one?
That one, yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
So what is it? What is it that we exactly do? We are an advanced technology. Just for those that aren't familiar with hydrolysis, it's a micro-level lysing of the biosolid material, opening up its nutrient value, opening up into a very, like, a pasteurization process. We do it at a low temperature. There are other technologies that operate at a much higher temperature, high pressure. Ours is a patented process operating at a basically a more economical temperature and pressure range. Our capacity is 150,000 wet tons. And what that means by numbers is the Bay Area produces about 1.5 million wet tons of biosolids per year. So we designed and built this facility to be a regional site. Fairfield, our host agency, only produces 15,000. So ultimately, Fairfield will be a very small participant. Our job is to basically be a regional, one of the regional solutions for the Bay Area. We can handle up to 200 tons at any one time. Some of the pictures I'll be showing talk about our reactors. We call them, that's the vessel that the material goes in and is processed. We have 30,000 cubic meters, close to 30,000 tons of Listigro, our fertilizer storage. And when we operated, signed our agreement with Fairfield, it's a 20-year operating lease with a 10-year extension, so we intend to be in business for at least 30 years out there, if not longer. And it allows us to expand our operations, not only taking biosolids, but as the movement of the industry is much more accepting of organic material, food waste, and the like, and liquid organic waste, our technology can expand to that. Very proud to say we've already hired 6 permanent employees. These are professional level people. We're not hiring minimum wage people. And it's a full benefit package for our employees. So this is what the storage unit looks like, that 200-ton storage. It's a large steel box, about 45 feet long, 15 feet high, and about 20 feet wide. And so on the bottom of it are some live conveyors that transport the material from the trucks that deliver it to us. The reactor is pretty much a blending machine, but there's a high-speed mixer in there, steam injectors for the heating process, and then there's a lime addition on the top. And the process takes about 30 to 45 minutes to meet the standard of the material, which by US EPA is a Class A exceptional quality, and that allows it for unrestricted use. The difference between that and Class B is Class B has seasonal restrictions in Solano County specifically. So we petitioned US EPA, and they gave us a rating of AEQ. We then went to the California Department of Food and Agriculture and got our material licensed as a bulk fertilizer, which means we guarantee a certain nutrient value. That allowed us to go to Solano County Environmental Health Division and petition not to be considered a biosolids material, which they agreed to. So we have basically an open year-round use, year-round potential to market our material and sell it as a commercial fertilizer. And the one thing that happens when Class B is generated and produced, certainly in Solano County, the farmers do not pay for a Class B material. So basically all the cost is borne by the generator for transportation and application. We actually produce the fertilizer and then sell it, so we do get a revenue stream out of it. And this is the overall site, yes?
So Class A, that can be applied to food products? And
it could be applied to consumer food products. We don't market that yet. There's still, like let's say, there's a public resistance to that. So most of our crops tend to be on the processing side. Wheat, alfalfa, safflower, clover for cattle and cattle grazing. So again, this is the facility. Fairfield Sassoon is about 450 acres of land. They had a very underutilized dewatering building. They had some old lagoons and drying beds that they've used regularly. We converted these lagoons to our storage, so our list to grow is stored in this facility here. The dewatering building was very underutilized. We used maybe 10% of this building for our equipment. Tanker trucks line up. We have a scale, we have a receiving pit, and this is what it looks like on a nice clear day without any smoke. So how did it get started? Jason mentioned briefly, we did open up our office 3 years ago. I was proud to be their first U.S. employee, and my job was to get the Fairfield site opened. We did CEQA in a total of 3 months. And I know, that's what a lot of people say. They usually say a little louder, like, really? Wow. My background is in the solid waste industry primarily, and it takes years to go through CEQA, especially on a controversial project. This was obviously much quicker. Fairfield was the lead agency, and their board approved this with the full period, even with the 45-day public comment period. So we were very proud of that. And a little bit of a shock to our Canadian friends, because they had no idea what CEQA was when they got into the process. Mm-hmm. Then after that, their board approved a 20-year agreement with us, and we were off to the races, and it took us 14 months to get the facility constructed. And August 16th is a milestone date for us. That was the date we transferred material from Fairfield to us, and I'm happy to say since that date, they have delivered 100% of their biosolids production to us for processing. And then after that, it was pretty much a good rapid growth. City of Santa Rosa became our first party right after that. Central Marin, exactly like almost a year ago to this month, that agreement was signed and began accepting material. East Bay Mud came over to us. They had an issue early in 2017 with some landfill issues where their provider, their transporter, was being cut off from landfill ADC, and they circled back on us. We provided them stop-and-go service for a couple months, and we got a little tired of being treated like a convenience store, so we said, if you're going to use us, you need to use us on a daily basis. So they're now delivering to us up till October 15th, 7 to 10 loads a week. After that, they'll be up to 15 to 16 loads a week, basically because the Same thing Jason mentioned. In the winter, much more restrictive uses for biosolids. One of the marquee names that we're very proud of is having to enter into agreement with the City and County of San Francisco. Always a challenge working with them and working for them. We spent years courting them, and I'd say they don't take lightly signing agreements with unknown parties. They did a rather thorough, I thought, due diligence of us. Found us worthy of contracting with, and we're under a two-year purchase order with extensions beyond that. And then just recently, the City of Petaluma signed with us. They also had landfill issues. They were cut off completely, and I had an emergency phone call in January, and we took some loads for them. They solved their problem, but they saw the handwriting on the wall, let's say, and we've now signed a multi-year agreement that allows them to bring minimal loads in the summer and 100% of their loads during the wet weather period. So this just gives a brief chart of what our how our volume distribution has been. Again, our host agency of Fairfield, certainly the bulk of the material in the beginning. What we're really happy about is August is the first month that a third-party material exceeded Fairfield. And that's really important because it kind of sustains our belief that we really are going to be a regional facility. The goal is that Fairfield would never be, you know, the majority of the host over time. So as those third parties grow, I'll be happy to get this graph much more, the values of it, and Fairfield will be really small, and hopefully third party will be really big. So the land application is where we're focusing on a little bit now. In the beginning of 2017, we began applying our fertilizer. This is what our land application equipment looks like. It is a 6,000-gallon tanker truck and injectors that basically subsurface apply our fertilizer below the surface. And that's been the method that was tried and true in Canada, and it has progressed very well for us here in Solano County. Another view of it, we've been taking pains to convince people that we basically are opening up a new market. No one really applies liquid fertilizer in the manner that we do. We work very closely with the Solano County Agricultural Commissioner, Jim Allen. Asked him to say a few kind words. He said, well, I can't exactly endorse ListTech, but I can certainly tell you exactly what I think of it. If biosolids being manufactured from, fertilizers being manufactured from biosolids in Solano County are, you know, a very good thing. Well, there's only one company doing that in Solano County, and that's us. And he sees the real benefit of what the micronutrients and the organic material can do to increase soil health, adhere to Governor Brown's Healthy Soils Initiative that he's been pushing for 2 years, and we think we're on the right track with that. We also contacted some of the farmers that we work with. This gentleman is a no-till farmer, so basically he doesn't believe that turning the soil on a regular basis is a good thing. And even though our process is a subsurface application, he still believes that what we do is compatible with his farming practices in maintaining a soil structure. And then finally, we had the United States EPA come out for a visit, and the same thing like the Solano County Ag Commissioner. She was very supportive of it. Again, couldn't mention our name in a quote, but basically said that liquid fertilizers that are subsurface applied using computer systems and loading rates follow in the highest level of what EPA is looking for. So we're very happy to kind of be accepted both at the federal and local level as doing the right thing. So in a nutshell, that's kind of it. But one of the things that we have for in our agreement with your agency is a sharing agreement. And while we have been selling our product, not making enough money to, I'd say, call it profit, but we felt it was important to recognize agencies like Centrum in the woods in the beginning. So my assistant will hand out a brief letter of kind of thank you, and we have a small, I guess, monetary check for Jason to deposit with you guys, kind of a recognition that you've been with us from the very beginning. We certainly appreciate the partnership. Look forward to continuing a long way. Go prior to that, I'll give you an envelope. So we certainly hope to make this an annual event. We're very, again, very proud of what we've been able to succeed. The company is very, very pleased with the reception they've received in the United States and again, the participation of the agencies that we've been able to gather as customers. So look forward to going on and on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim.
Would you be willing to entertain a couple of questions if we have some?
Certainly.
Okay. Anybody have any questions? Well, I'm kind of curious about the actual soil injection process. Is it deep? Is that one farmer who's a no-till?
Right.
If that farmer accepts it, obviously it doesn't disrupt the structure of the soil too much.
Right. So there's a small cutting called a shank, mm-hmm. basically a hook or a knife that cuts the soil about an inch and a half, 2 inches wide, about 3 to 4 inches deep. The liquid material, in rapid succession, this whole thing happens in a 3-foot process. The liquid material is injected in this, there, in the opening, and then two small, call it disking wheels, put the soil back over the top and seals it up.
So it's kind of sprayed in there and then covered up?
A little heavier than a spray.
Okay.
It comes out rather quickly.
Okay.
So I'd say, you know, more in the range of about, in the space of this, you might get 2 gallons of the material.
Okay. Now, does Listic handle that process, or you simply sell the product and the farmers then need the equipment to handle the
that
liquid fertilizer?
Farm implement that you saw is ours. So
oh,
we purchased it. We
okay.
have hired a local farmer. In fact, it was a no-till farmer that acts as our contractor.
Okay.
And so we find farms. He then applies it for us. He's nothing more than a subcontractor to us.
Can you use it on food crops like lettuce or strawberries? Or?
Well, again, being subsurface injected, you know, it's not prone for like a spraying type. Yeah. It is a black material. Biosolids is black by nature. And so we're concerned about the spotting it would cause on any type of a leaf crop. But from a subsurface injection, it'd be fine.
Mm-hmm.
We're just now ready to take on individually the issues of human waste biosolids still being used on direct food crops.
Yeah.
An example I give in Solano County is Campbell's Soup has a very large factory in Solano County. And tomatoes, I think, are the second, this year they were the second crop by monetary value in Solano County.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to risk going to Campbell's, even convincing them this was safe, and then having someone like Heinz use it as a marketing angle by saying, well, why would you eat Campbell's tomato soup made from human waste? Which the industry is not ready to accept that yet. So.
Yeah.
Solano County has about 120,000 acres of agricultural land. At our maximum build-out of our facility, we would need maybe 20,000 acres to apply all of our material.
Mm-hmm.
So. And that's just in Solano County. We feel that our product is can be shipped relatively a good distance, Yolo County, Lake County, maybe even Sacramento County. So, not yet, but we'd like to be the first, but we don't want to be the first and last.
And also, what kind of testing, I presume you do testing to ensure there's not active biological?
Right. So our process is we call it time and temperature. U.S. EPA requires a minimum amount of time at a certain temperature to guarantee pathogen reduction,
mm-hmm.
pathogen elimination. We then do a 40-day retest, which then certifies that the material has met the requirements for any type of pathogen regrowth. At our Canadian facility, it's the same test but a different regulation. And in our 4 or 5 years up there, we've had no repeat tests that have shown pathogen regrowth. So far the year we've been operating here, the same thing. We've had no pathogen regrowth detected in our resample.
Okay.
And then we spot check every test from every load that comes in through a QAQC. We get annual reports from the different agencies that they met the EPA 503 rules and any of their local NPDES rules.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Great. Well, thank you very much.
Great.
It's very interesting.
Again, thank you again.
Your assistant was marvelous.
Yes.
Thank you for coming.
All right, moving on to agenda item 11, Marin County Adult Offender Work Program.
Okay, so this is a proposal for the board, and it started with our maintenance supervisor, Paul Bremer, who used to work for the city of Daly City. And the city utilized the San Mateo County Adult Offender Work Program. And, Paul had a great experience with that. He saw a lot of benefits to the city, working with some of those, participants in the program, in terms of, having additional, resources and workers, things of that nature. So Paul brought the idea at CMSA and proposed that we should maybe talk about it and evaluate the pros and cons and the benefits and then consider participating in Marin County's program. So we've done that internally, had a few meetings, you know, to talk about it. We've contacted a couple of the local agencies that have utilized, you know, the program participants, such as MMWD, which has been involved with 20 years, about 20 years with the program for landscape management in a lot of their watershed areas. And we also had several discussions with, you know, the staff at the county probation department about it, and they have very strict screening requirements for, you know, the participants, and a lot of other good information. But with that, I'll just introduce Paul, because he has a lot of good knowledge and working experience with the program, and he can give you a brief overview
good
of how it works,
everybody.
And answer any questions.
Thank you for allowing myself to present you guys with some insight and info from the local participants, some feedback from them. Like Jason said, the Adult Offender Work Program is a low-risk, low-risk defendants such as DUI convictions, first-time offenders, and it basically is stay instead of a minimal prison sentence or a jail sentence of up to 28 days. So they can work off their time, still go to work, schedule it around so that they can fill in their time and still serve their sentence. Like Jason said, Marin Municipal Water District's been a participant for over 20 years. They help clear trails, watershed. They've created brush removal, weed abatement, defensible space for fire protection. We also contacted the Marin Law Library, and they also use the system. They use the Adult Offender Work Program for filing updates to current law documents. They have financial background participants that have assisted with creating sophisticated Excel sheets for filing, spreadsheets. When you sign up for the program, you can actually ask for specific tasks or specific skills that some of the people may have. The law library actually had a broadcast journalist who was helping them do a short film for the library's use for training. So it's a diverse program. Not everybody is a criminal, or people get stuck in situations and they're just serving their time back to the community. So it's a good program to help give back to the county. It takes a little bit of it helps with their resources. It helps with public agencies. They can do anything from weed whacking to painting to, you can ask for, like I said, specific skills. If you have concrete finishers, to patch concrete. And so some of my visions here for the agency is just assist with some landscaping maintenance and enhancement projects. We have painting and coating, process piping, and facility areas. Again, defensible space and brushwork along the road up here, the meadows and some of the grass work that we contract out sometimes yearly. As I said, you can request for certain skills, or to have offenders with certain criteria not be brought to your sites. So you can actually ask for, like, no sex offenders, no criminal, no, you know, to certain areas. Some of the rules through the county is each participant is expected to be a productive member of the agency's crew with regard to performance, attitude, and attire. If any offender is at any time is unwilling or unable to perform tasks as requested, you can ask them to leave the site, and they're to go back to the county sheriff, and they will have to reinstate themselves in the program. This program is it's highly screened. They have to pay to get into the program. It's not court ordered. So you actually have to put forth your own time, your own money, apply before you're even allowed to go onto a work site. So I think that's a little beneficial. So people are screened really well. Like I said, there's a broad cast of people that you could request different skills. My current experience with the program in San Mateo County, At the City of Daly City, we had the treatment plant. We used them within there to paint facility pipelines, landscaping. We also did all the drinking water reservoirs, so we had them clearing reservoirs, vegetation, whatnot, painting the sides of the tanks. It was very beneficial. Currently, there's two employees here. We just hired a new utility worker, Derek Rice, and he came from us from the City of Hillsborough, which ultimately uses San Mateo County Adult Offender Work Program as well. So we have a couple staff members that are, well versed with it. They know the program. Some of the program requirements and some of the functions that staff here would have to do is sign in and out workers for the day. You have to time card management, basically just accounting for their days to make sure they're checked in for the day, and then just work oversight, ensuring they stay on site, ensuring they stay in their work area, and ensuring they're performing their tasks as asked of them. Adult offender work programs, they're not allowed usually in the facility unless supervised. They're, like I said, they're staying in their work area. They take their breaks in their work area. And, one of the other things we did with the adult offender work program was we had them in designated vests so the other staff and members could easily locate, understand the work crews that are on site. So I would appreciate your thought into accepting the adult offender work program. I think it would be a good benefit to the agency. Could definitely help some of the staff and make sure of the appearance and take care of some utility tasks a little bit better and help us get some work done.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Appreciate your time. Thank
anybody
you.
Have any questions for Paul?
No, I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, there's no cost to the agency to participate. And as you probably saw in the staff report, that during one of the many meetings we had with SEIU over some other matters, we brought this up. We provided them with the program documentation from the probationary department. We gave them an overview of the program and how we utilize these additional resources, what we perceived as one of the benefits at the time. And we heard back from SEIU's field representative, in addition to with our lead steward, and they said we think it's a good idea. We don't have any concerns with CMSA participating in the adult offender work program.
Okay, so no questions?
I just have one. So it's a free program. We don't pay the wage.
That's right.
And do you have an estimate? Are we going to assign a staff person that's going to handle these? Because you're going to bring them on, get them properly trained, make sure they know the safety rules.
Yeah, we have a couple of utility worker staff that we've talked about internally. That'd be a good development opportunity for them to supervise the staff, work with the probation department, and figure out what they need to do to oversee these, program participants, and then give them, safety training, welcome to the work site, schedule the work, assign the work, and periodically go out and monitor the work to make sure that they're also on site, that they're performing the work properly, that they're not leaving the site, and they're following all the other programmatic requirements established by the probationary department. And then, kind of mentioned in the staff report, it does free up some of our staff utility worker time to go support the other departments, operations department, the mechanical, electrical staff in the maintenance department, where they could, be set of helping hands for a mechanical electrician, which is covered in their job description. But right now, with all the painting and the cleanup work and custodial activities and landscape work, the three of those utility workers are pretty busy all the time just doing that. They don't have the opportunity to broaden their work experience and do some of these other, essential job functions that we included into that that job description a couple years ago.
One quick question, Paul. Mm-hmm. Do they get paid?
They do not.
They get nothing?
No. So basically they are serving their time out free instead of being locked up for their 10-day sentence, their 15-day sentence. So they actually pay to get into the program rather than serve their time in jail.
Okay.
Do you know how much they pay to enter the program?
I do not. I can get that information for you, though. And then back to your question, the Maria Cozy, the director of the program, they actually have an orientation training for the staff, too, where they'd come in and do an orientation for the staff that would be overseeing and give them kind of the guidelines and the rules. And I mean, these are real world people, and, so they want them to be treated respectfully, just as they want them treating us respectfully and everything else. So they're, it's a good resource. I think it would be beneficial to the agency.
Okay, well, thank you for bringing it to us.
Thank you.
Okay. Would any member of the public like to speak to this? See none, I will bring it back for discussion and possible consideration authorizing the agency's participation. I had just a couple of comments that I wanted to make. I appreciated that Paul mentioned that there might be certain types of offenders we would not necessarily want at the facility. He mentioned sex offenders. I would agree with that one, just considering this is a work environment. I think we need to be careful of that. I would also say anybody that's been involved with use of explosives or arson, just because we have a duty to protect this facility. And I would think that, or I would recommend that maybe you consider if there's anything else, or maybe work with the folks that administer this program for their suggestions as to maybe what other types of offenders we might want to exclude.
Definitely do that.
Sure. Just through the chair, they're already screened for non-violent offenders. I read that.
Right.
That's correct. That's our understanding, yeah.
But they're already non-violent. So is arson violent?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Who knows?
Yeah.
I just felt the need to say that.
Okay.
No, I agree with you.
Protect
right.
The facility.
I appreciate the fact that our staff brings ideas from one agency to another. I think that's it's a big advantage of public agencies. They're happy to share good ideas different than companies who don't want to see them.
Thanks for making it. I am going to have to tell Pat Sweet when you stole his idea.
He is retired.
Okay. And I'm going to look up there in the camera in case there's anybody who administers this program watching us, although nobody ever watches these meetings. But I think it's almost a little disappointing that the applicants actually have to pay a fee to apply for this program. You know, we talk about social equity, and I would hate to think that payment of a fee might become a barrier to certain lower-income folks being eligible for this kind of a project. So maybe they offer a waiver. I don't know. If they don't, please offer a waiver. I think that would be
fair. Are you suggesting a scholarship program?
I will not be suggesting that nor administrating it, but maybe you could, Dan.
I'm just asking a question.
All right. I'm prepared to move that we authorize the agency's participation in the Marin County Adult Offender Work Program.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? That was unanimous.
Thank you. Great program.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you for your time.
See you all, Paul.
Good night.
All right. Agenda item 12, draft sea level rise assessment 2017, agency facilities master plan.
Thank you, Chair. First. So last year in September, the board approved a contract with Kroll Engineers to develop a master plan for the agency that has 11 specific tasks in the master plan. And there was a pretty, tight schedule to start out with, and we've expanded that schedule, for a variety of reasons. And because of that schedule expansion and the board not seeing the presentation until probably, anywhere from the February-March meeting of 2018, we thought internally it would be good just to, as we receive these draft or final draft technical memoranda, to give the board a briefing on it, tell you what the scope of work was, what were some of the key findings, what staff thinks about these various activities and some of the recommendations, and how we're going to maybe address those or incorporate some of these into the capital program or make a recommendation to the finance committee to include that into our next multi-year revenue program. Because one thing we wanted to avoid is that Kroll Engineers comes into the board meeting, say in February 2018, and gives you this long presentation with all these very technical, detailed topics without you being up to speed on some of these things. So we thought it'd be good just to bring them to you so you're familiar with these topics before we have the big presentation next year. So along that thought line, we did start this up back at the July meeting, and I gave presentations on, you know, the blending alternative reduction tasks, which you were pretty familiar with from the prior December and the decision of the no feasible alternative that we selected. Also the condition assessment of the agency's facilities, and then also the biosolids dewatering alternatives. So those three, you know, technical analyses are pretty much in final draft form. They have our comments, and they're converting those to final documents. So tonight we have the next report that's in draft form from Kroll Engineers, and that's the sea level rise assessment. And the scope of work on this task was really focused in on how would the sea level rise, as determined by the Marin Bay Wave, you know, modeling and project, affect CMSA's property and CMSA's facilities. And then more specifically, how would that impact the agency's ability to discharge, you know, our treated wastewater to the San Francisco Bay? And the original scope was just, you know, the pump discharge, because during, you know, wet weather season and high tide events, we use our effluent pump station to pump the water out, because we're limited on gravity flow, you know, hydraulics from the plant to the bay. Anyways, so I have a lot of attachments to the staff report that I could walk through, but essentially the key findings are that CMSA's property and equipment and facilities are not impacted by the projected sea level rise with the 100-year flood event for the near term, which is 2030, the midterm 2050, and a long-term 2100 sea level rise events. However, you see on some of the attachments that Anderson Drive is projected to be flooded for any of the events. And as you go forward in the future, more of Highway 580 is flooded. And then you look at 2100, if no mitigation is done, you know, most of the area across the freeway from us is all flooded. So one activity that we're definitely going to do is we're going to be in constant, you know, communication, well, periodic communication with the San Rafael Department of Public Works, just to learn what they're doing in terms of sea level rise planning for some of the local roadways, because if those are flooded, that's going to have a significant impact on just employees commuting to work and delivery of supplies and materials and a lot of the process chemicals that we rely on here. So just looking at the diagrams, the first diagram is just a picture, satellite picture of a CMSA where our outfall is, and this is just kind of a representation of where the outfall is. It's not too exact. Then the next couple slides show the 2030 near-term and long-term, you know, sea level rise projections from the Bay Wave model. Then one thing we did, you know, about a month and a half ago is we amended the scope of work with Corollo, and that's because our contract divers had just completed the annual inspection of the diffuser section of our outfall. So our outfall goes about 2 miles out into the San Francisco Bay. That's from the end of the plant to the bay. In the last, you know, 1,000 feet is in a deeper shipping channel. And so the treated wastewater, you know, is discharged through ports, about 176 of these ports along that diffuser section. So you have proper mixing and dilution to meet regulatory requirements with the San Francisco Bay waters. And over the last, you know, few years, we had the annual inspection by the divers. They've reported to us that the bay floor was encroaching on a lot of the diffuser heads that discharge the water. And then at the outer end of the outfall, you know, 20, 30, even 40 of them were covered, you know, with the bay mud. At the time when we were receiving the reports, we weren't too concerned about it because it was during the drought. And we thought, okay, there's not a lot of snowmelt, not a lot of river flow coming in to mobilize the sediments on the bay floor and move them around. What we had seen for the decades prior is 1 year you may have the bay floor that's, you know, a foot from the diffuser head. The next year it's 3 feet away. So there's always, you know, movement of the soils. So because of the drought and the findings from the investigation or the inspection, we weren't concerned, but we said, well, when it rains heavy again, there'll be a lot of river flow coming into the San Pablo Bay and central San Francisco Bay, and it'll remobilize that material and uncover some of these diffuser heads. Well, that didn't happen this last year. We had some pretty significant events, so they're still buried. We're not as concerned as in the past if that were to occur because we have the effluent pump station, you know, to pump the water out under pressure in the outfall. But we figured, you know, most of the year, you know, we gravity flow out. So how does, you know, having all these, you know, buried diffusers affect the gravity flow, you know, operation of the outfall? So that's what's shown on this next graph. So you see the red line is gravity flow at low tide, where there's a lot of potential energy to send the water out. And the blue line is at high tide, when there's not a lot of elevation difference between the end of the contact tanks and the high tide. So you see that ranges from 133 million gallons per day to 81.5. Then on the horizontal axis at the bottom, you see those numbers, and that is diffusers that are not operating. So kind of in the modeling, those are buried. So you see you have a reduction in the gravity flow as you have more buried diffusers. But it's not too significant. So one thing that, you know, I just sent out our staff's comments on this draft technical memo just before the board meeting, and I asked their project manager to go ahead and update this graph with the gravity flow impacts due to the 2030 near-term sea level rise. So the final draft document will have a couple other lines on here lower than these two other lines, just to show here's normal operation, here's operation with sea level rise, with 100-year flood in 2030, and this is how it all decreases over time as, you know, diffusers are not operational or, in essence, buried. So that's something that you guys will see after when you see the report from Crollo in early next year. And the last graph is for the pumped operation of the effluent pump station. So you see at the left-hand side was zero, so all 176, you know, risers and diffusers are operating. We have, you know, and you have the design high tide event, we have 140 MGD output. Then with the sea level rise, we have 133. So it's only a 6 MGD decrease, not too significant. And then as you have less diffusers in operation, go out to 60, you're at 137 and 131. We're not too concerned about that. So there's plenty of hydraulic capacity in the effluent pump station. Especially, you know, this last winter, we had our highest peak flow, 121, which is a lot less than, you know, what we're showing on the graph, even with sea level rise and with, you know, a third of the diffusers, you know, covered up. And we know that the satellite collection agencies, you know, have, you know, significant programs to reduce iodine into the collection system, which over time will reduce the influent flows during peak weather events and utilize less of the outfall capacity, which is a good thing. So anyway, so that's just kind of my summary report on the findings of this draft memo. And let you know there's a couple, you know, little changes we're going to ask Crollo to make to have a little more information in there for, you know, some of the sea level rise events for gravity flow operation. So I can answer any questions or?
Any questions, Tom?
Yeah, you know, I think if I'm looking at attachment two, you know, the water is covering Anderson Drive, so probably a lot of properties too. And so while our CMSA facilities are not high and dry, but dry anyway, we could get a huge amount of iodine, and that would affect us quite a bit. And if you look at the 100-year one, boy, that would be impossible to handle, probably. Unless the bones or whatever, I don't know.
Yeah, that's a great observation. We're hoping by 2030 the satellite agencies have tightened up a lot of that collection system around these areas that could be flooded.
Well, that's a question I have is, my understanding of sea level rise is that even before the impacts seen by the water kind of slapping at you on your front porch, the failure of the water and sewer systems inland are going to be first. Through this surge of saltwater evaporation,
yeah,
so I'm wondering, have the joint member agencies or MMWD done an assessment to these events and levels of sea level rise so that you can see those? And
yeah, I'm not aware of, you know,
because if all those things fail,
the satellite agencies,
your,
you know,
worries here are kind of complicated.
You know, we've seen that.
This has happened already up in the Northwest around Seattle.
Right. I think, are you specifically referring to whether or not MMWD has done something similar and is embarking on a thorough evaluation of what they might be facing?
My question has MMWD and the member collection agencies, have they looked at sea level rise relative to the collection system? And if the kind of caricatures of the way I understand the impacts are going to take place, with infrastructure failing inland before you actually start seeing water getting higher, creeping in around properties. Won't those complicate a lot on top of what we're seeing here?
But apropos of what Jason was saying, we know we have some areas, like, let's say the Larkspur Boardwalk, where when we have a king tide along with sea level rise, even right now, we have salt water flowing directly into the system. And that's one of the areas that, from our INI emphasis that we're trying to do, that we're attacking currently via smoke testing to find out when that happens. But we see it already. When that happens, we have it, when we have the king tide, we can see the amount of that it affects what's coming into Jason currently. So we hopefully are going to get that under control long before that time.
Well, in the event, whether it's predictable or not, that the collection system fails because of...
Well, why would it fail? I mean, there would be more infiltration than inflow. So it isn't going to collapse. We're just going to be pushing more water. You know, if it's underwater, if it's not underwater now and it becomes underwater, yeah, probably we'll get more INI. And so I know that we're looking at it, I'm sure the others are too, and just like Michael said, I don't know why the water district, I don't understand that, but, you know, so run out the water district and the wastewater.
I'm just wondering,
our solution is to tighten our pipes.
Okay.
And we have spent a lot of money doing just that, and we've got an ongoing continuous program.
You know, what I'll do is at the next JPA manager meeting, I'll give them a briefing on, you know, this report from this, you know, parole analysis, and I'll just ask them, you know, do they have any plans to perform any seal rise assessments? Have they started that? You know, when they think to look at it, I can let you guys know.
I guess the question I'm trying to get to is how do those considerations affect what we're talking about here?
Yeah, well, those are clearly outside the scope of Crowley, but just for this discussion, I don't see the nexus between the water district's sea level rise evaluation on the distribution system and the reservoirs affecting CMSA's business, except for delivery of, you know, potable water possibly to us. For the JPA, agencies, you guys have talked about that a little bit. I mean, that could happen. You know, for the low-lying areas, there could potentially be more INI into the system. And then there's a couple things that they have to think about and assess. Do they have capacity in the system to handle that additional INI, or is that going to create sewer overflows? And if they have the capacity to get it to the pumping stations, do they have the capacity there to transport it to CMSA? And I don't have an answer to those questions.
And is that information, just for my own interest, available?
That information, like
on the collection system in the present day.
Well, we've got an ongoing program, the IMP.
IMAP.
Yeah, we have an ongoing program of, you know, replacing our pipes to reduce INI, and we have seen the maps. We've seen the Bay Wave maps,
okay.
And we've located Larkspur as a problem area, and. All three of our agencies have problem areas.
Mm-hmm. We just spent more than $1 million in Paradise K,
yeah.
Which folks don't realize is part of Sanitary District Number 2. But if you've ever been out there, there's a main street going out, and then it's fingers leading out from there, and they end in cul-de-sacs. Well, guess what? That's fill. And over the years, the ends have started to sink. Well, that doesn't quite work when you've got a gravity sewer. So we had to go out there and adjust where the sewer line was, which included replacing more than 20 laterals. And we raised the sewer line as high as we possibly could to allow the laterals to operate on gravity. We couldn't go any higher with the actual sewer main, and it's going to continue to sink. And I'm worried that with sea level rise and all of that additional infiltration of seawater, that might hasten further sinking. And then I don't know if the county is going to come in and just add asphalt on top, which doesn't really help us with the sewer main. So we might eventually have to put in pump stations. So we all should be thinking that this is going to be more than just INI. There might be all kinds of other things related to it. And yes, it's going to get very complicated and very costly. And we'll just do our best to address it. And I'm sorry, Dean, you had your hand up earlier. Did you want to say something?
I have a couple comments.
Go for it.
The biggest thing, I think, getting water, getting the stuff flows here is with our collection agencies and pump stations. Because wherever, you know, we have our transformers and electrical power feeds to them, and our backup generators, all those have to be pretty well above the flood levels. And that's what's going to kill the whole program. I mean, getting flows here is through pump stations. So that's with our member agencies to sort of make sure we're above these sea levels here, or these rising levels. But the instant thing that came to mind looking at these photos is how our employees going to get here. And that's a huge issue on just operating this treatment plant. Is we're going to be an island here. 101's going to be, unless they bring up 101 south in Corte Madera, 101 through San Rafael, Anderson Drive, 580, we're going to just be an island sitting here. So that's an instant issue of just operating this whole plant.
That's for sure.
I don't
know
what sort of coordination is going on regionally with Caltrans and any of the city roads and county roads too.
Well, I know that the city of San Rafael, I believe it's a city, made an put in an application to Resilient by Design for the canal, the great, both the Central Canal District and I believe the Greater Canal Area, as a potential site. Kate Collin was telling me about that. As a potential site for a design competition for addressing sea level rise. Mm-hmm. Just so happened, Corte Madera submitted Mariner Cove as the greater Mariner Cove as a site that we're offering up for the same design competition. But anyway,
likely sure Councilmember Collins' application will.
really, we're going to get competitive here. Anywho. Hopefully Marin County will have a site that's selected as the winning site, and this like world-class design team will come in and try to address it. I'm guessing pretty much every site that was submitted had to do with protecting against bay waters coming in. So what that looks like, I don't know. I mean, is it going to be levees? Is it going to be seawalls? Is it just going to be concrete berms like we see around El Pollo Loco? I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But there are a lot of people talking. Uh-huh. Not a whole lot of money getting thrown anywhere quite yet, but knock on wood.
Those flat-bottom boats. And
we can bring the ferry around.
The wind planes. Or the wind boats.
Maybe waders will come into style.
Okay.
What is the total number of diffusers we have on that outpost?
176.
And so, how many we got buried now?
You know, about 40. You know, Brian, our technical service manager, is here. He may have a more exact number than that.
I think it's 36.
Okay.
36. But 35 to 40 range, somewhere in there.
So about 20% of them.
And you could just extend some of them, right, like 5 feet or...
So every year when we do the inspection, we also include riser extension for 5. If we know we have a lot, maybe 10 diffusers, and the divers will take them out on the boat. They'll find the ones that they can uncover, and then they'll extend those up and raise them as well.
So these figures then that we're looking at in this table, is their actual figures and what we're currently doing with low and high tides?
The actual lines on here?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the results of the hydraulic evaluations.
Okay.
Yeah.
So does it match pretty well with what plant performance does during these events?
The outfall has such significant capacity during most of the year, we don't see any impacts, even track any of this.
Okay.
Because the outfall, most of the year our flows anywhere from, 3 MGD and the low flow period during the day to maybe 13 during the day, during the morning flush periods. And those are well inside the low end capacity, even at the highest of high tides. So no way to track on that. But when you get the peak of weather events, we could measure that a little closer. Now we just use the effluent pump station.
But you can't check the 130 because you don't have the flow.
Right.
You only got 141.
Only.
Yeah. And that was just for a short period of time. But Dan, I will bring this up with JP managers and we'll have a discussion on it and I'll just ask them about what plan they're doing and what their thoughts are on sea level rise.
It would just be nice to know if we need to think about a broader set of impacts.
Sure. Appreciate that.
Any other questions? Any member of the public like to speak to this?
Can we take a 1 minute break?
Absolutely. Do you feel you have sufficient direction on this item?
Yeah,
okay,
definitely.
Good. Okay, take a minute break and we'll be back in a minute. Okay, welcome back. Agenda item 13, draft MCE power purchase agreement. Jason, would you like to introduce this? And then I believe Mary Beth might have a comment about this.
Sure. So the board authorized the agency to prepare and negotiate a power sale agreement with Marine Clean Energy. So we've been working on that. We received their standard small power generator purchase agreement from them, which is designed really for solar type facilities. We reviewed that. Our energy consultants reviewed it, and our contract construction law firm has reviewed that also. They had a lot of comments, and we've worked with MCE to prepare some revisions for the agreement. We had a lot of recommended revisions. MCE, accepted maybe, 35% of the revisions, roughly. And those are shown in the attached agreement. And then they're also summarized in the staff report. The one comment from the board at the May meeting, when we received authorization, to negotiate the agreement, was that the board would prefer a shorter term than a 20-year term. So they were agreeable to having a 10 or a 15-year term in addition to the 20-year term. And that we do have a reserved purchase price of 10.5 cents per kilowatt hour, which is in the condition 2 table that's shown in the draft agreement. And right now we understand that MCE is at condition 6 because they've, since they approved our feed-in tariff application and reserved that condition 2 level, they've, contracted with other entities to provide power. So each condition has, a certain, range of megawatts, and once they have contracts to hit that level, then it goes down to the next condition, and the purchase price is usually lower as you go down the conditions. So we have the 10.5 cent condition 2 for base load reserved for us through the feed-in tariff. And we also include in the staff report a brief discussion on CMSA's purchase price for energy, which is pretty complex through our tariff, but we have a Marine Clean Energy generation price. We have a PG&E electrical distribution and transportation piece. Each component has time of use charges. Those change in different seasons of the year. They also have demand charges and peak demand charges, which get very expensive in the tides of the highest 15 minutes, energy demand through the period. And you can see in the staff report that we pay anywhere from 15 cents kilowatt hour up to, 75 cents kilowatt hour, depending on how much energy we're actually producing at CMSA. The more we produce, the more we buy, the lower the kilowatt hour is. The more we produce, the higher it is because the demand transportation charges, I mean, the distribution transportation charges increase quite a bit relative to the generation component of the bill. So that's kind of that's shown in there also. Then lastly, our energy consultant did do some research. He went to the California Energy Commission website, looked at all of the entities that are selling renewable power in the PG&E service area, and that's shown on one of the tables in the staff report. And you can also see what the sale purchase price is. And those range from, I forget the range, 8 cents per kilowatt hour up to about 12.5 cents, which is the PG&E biomat FIT rate, which we're not eligible for. So just looking at, what others are selling power for relative to what, our reserved amount is, we're in a pretty good position at 10.5 cents. We've also learned that the Sonoma County Water Agency sells renewable hydroelectric power to, an energy aggregator up in that area, and that's at 6 cents a kilowatt hour. Then the County of Sonoma runs a landfill, produces, landfill gas, and that is generates power, and that's sold to the Sacramento Municipal Utilities District at 5.5 cents per kilowatt hour. So our rate that's been reserved for us is very competitive to what's being, offered to others within PG&E and outside the PG&E service area. But anyways, that's kind of, that's the end of my staff report on this. I can answer any questions.
Are we generating excess power?
Not yet. There are
Why not until that point? Aren't we just buying what we need over what we produce at a rate that's not going up and down?
Well, right now we have the ability to produce about 95 to 96% of our power, and we have to purchase a small amount of power from Marine Clean Energy to prevent us from exporting. We do have a new interconnection agreement with PG&E that will allow us to deliver power, but, they have to make some improvements to their system, which is underway. That should be wrapped up, by March of 2018. We have to make improvements to our control systems to allow us to deliver power to meet some of their, requirements. And that's scheduled to be done around the same time period. So once those projects are done, we get certification from PG&E that our improvements are made and comply with their requirements. And we have the meter installed. Then we can start delivering power. Concurrent to that, we need to expand our organic waste program to receive more materials so we generate more biogas and reach energy self-sufficiency. Then we can deliver power.
Is there something strange? It sounds strange to. Is it a disincentive on the rate side for us to be generating more?
No, the rates are the same. What happens is you just have different rates for different times of day, and you have different rates for different seasons, and you have different demand charges. So, like when I said that our rates, what we pay is, when I say what we pay is, it's not what we pay, it's our total bill.
Right.
Say like $100,000 for a month divided by the amount of power we actually buy, and that simple math gives you a dollar per or a cent per kilowatt hour, and that ranges based on how much we're producing. The more we're producing, the less we're buying on the generation side, but we're still paying a lot on the transportation distribution side, and to have some reservation of standby allocation.
Thank you.
We're
good.
Item 13, I hate to start off with an apology, but I have not completed a detailed review of this and really am not prepared to discuss it, and that's my fault. But I have some fairly serious questions about some provisions of it that I think, because this item is not time sensitive, could bear some additional study and discussion with the general manager. And I think that the most productive use of our time might be to appoint a subcommittee or an ad hoc committee to look into this really important document for the agency and to work through it and then bring back to the entire board.
Thank you.
Sounds good to me.
I nominate Mary Beth and Diane.
I am not an expert in this. But is there anybody else who might be?
I'm not.
I'm an expert in it.
And someone who understands numbers would be really helpful, too. There we go. Okay. Which one?
We can have both of them.
Can we have three?
You got three?
You can get three because the quorum is four.
Well, who wants to make that motion?
Someone, in the interest of that this could be for 20 years, none of us are going to be here. I hope in 20 years. I vote that we push this off until a later time.
And form a committee.
And form a committee consisting of Dean, Mary Beth, and Tom.
Okay, so.
I withdraw my motion. Say so moved.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? That was unanimous. Thank you very much. A lot of technical language in this, and it's very important we get it right. So thank you, three of you, for embarking on that effort.
And we've reserved our spot for the REIT. Correct.
Yeah, that's reserved until March of 2018 also.
Okay.
But I think there's a provision in the application to allow us to extend that. Brian, do you want that?
There is a provision that we can extend that, provided that we're making significant progress towards being able to export power, which we need to do.
We're doing that.
Yeah, we're moving our interconnection agreement, so we're good.
All right, moving on. Agenda item 14, North Bay Watershed Association report. Shall I take that one?
Sure.
All right. Well, there were actually three of us that were present. Well, you were there. I went. Jason went. We had a little field trip to the Sonoma County Water Agency facilities up in the Forestville area, and it was very interesting. First of all, it was a gorgeous fall day, and beautiful facilities, or series of facilities on the Russian River. We started out at their Water Education Center, which is a really beautiful facility. We saw a bunch of kids coming in. Evidently, they have all the Sonoma County, what is it, fifth graders or something like that, come through for
several
water
thousand.
Education, which I thought was, what's that?
Several thousand over the year.
Several thousand each year. So that in and of itself was very impressive. Then we took a tour out to one of their six collectors. Their collectors are essentially wells that collect groundwater. So they don't literally take the water out of the Russian River, which probably the majority of us might have thought. At least I certainly thought before I got there. But instead, near the river, the oldest ones are right adjacent to the river, the next oldest are a little further away, the more recent ones are further yet. But they have drilled down about 100 feet, and the groundwater percolates up. Now, that is groundwater that is very much replenished from the river, but it has gone through that percolation, so it is very pure water. They chlorinate it, and it goes into the distribution system. That is all, well, of course, they test it. But that is all they do. They do no other further purification, which I thought
that's
was very
why they have wells. They have the they don't have the surface treatment requirement.
Mm-hmm.
They have well water. So that's very smart of them. And then the filtration is done by the sand, probably.
Yeah.
I can add just quick little one which I thought was kind of fun piece of information. Fred McMurray owned all that land, and they bought it from him.
Okay.
It was a McMurray ranch.
My three sons.
Yeah.
My three sons, Fred McMurray. That was number one. And number two, when they dig that hole 100 feet down, just a few seconds, they build like a 10-foot section above the ground, and then they put an excavator in the middle of it. It's like 20 feet across, I think.
Something like that.
And they excavate. As they're excavating, that piece is moving down. Then they do another 10-foot section on top. And they excavate more, and they keep on doing that till they get to 100 feet. And they can keep the water from coming in until they get to the bottom, and then they have to put these laterals out, at which point there'd be so much water in they could never put the laterals in. So during that time that they're putting the laterals, they have to pressurize the well.
Mm.
And they have to send people down, and they have a hyperbaric chamber on the surface with a doctor, a hyperbaric medicine guy, because they have to decompress those guys as they come out of the well each day.
And the laterals go a couple of hundred feet, right?
Yeah.
Didn't they say about 200 feet? So it's fingers of perforated pipe going out from this.
And they discovered this originally, apparently, while doing the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yeah, there's a great
they had some guy, the foreman came out and got bent one day and died. Anyway, so.
When
they were putting the footings in at the
moment.
Rob Bolin, the chief engineer, got to build this.
Yeah.
I was going to say, this sounds very much like bridge building.
Yeah.
It used to be down in those holes.
Really?
They operated the phones.
Wow. So, we got to see that.
Cool.
Then, and by the way, they are up above, of course, the level of the river, because they've got all these pumps which need to be out of the flood zone. Mm-hmm. So the older ones are up on kind of a tower, so the well is down below, the collector well, and then the pump is up above, and the workers have to climb up a ladder to do all the maintenance, mm-hmm. presumably hauling all the equipment and everything. Mm-hmm. We were at one of the newer ones that actually had an earthen, you know, berm around it, so they could actually drive a truck up, which is nice that they didn't make us climb the ladder. So then we all piled in our little vans and went out past a couple of ponds that they have where they pull from the Russian River to fill up the ponds. It doesn't have to be real deep, and that percolates down to help replenish the groundwater. And a couple of the newer collector wells was out there. But we also went to where they have a temporary water-filled inflatable dam and a really awesome fish ladder. There were remnants of a little tiny old fish ladder, and I, you know, can just imagine that it was extremely difficult for the fish to navigate that. The new one is really, truly amazing. They have, where the water is coming down over this inflatable dam, underneath there they have a easy flowing channel, so the fish come up, they get in that, they are directed kind of to the left where the ladder is. They go along this building with windows, so you can actually walk down there and look through the windows and watch the fish swimming up, and then they come out into a big open area where they can easily get back into the river above the dam. There is where they take water from the river. Intake structure, I guess, for one of the groundwater replenishing ponds, and they have engineered that so that with this very fine mesh, so that none of the little fry get stuck in the mesh. So it's actually really well thought out. They even have a camera and lights on one of the windows, so that they can not only monitor the fish that go by using a camera and sonar and everything else, but they can take video of it, and they sometimes put that on their website.
In addition, about the guy who was driving our van came and talked to North Bay Watershed about 4 or 5 months ago, and they catch those fish at various places along the Russian River, and they inject them back here in the fleshy part with a little sensor that's the size of a piece of rice. And then as it goes past that one window, they can actually track how many times has the fish been this way and this way, and they've named some of the
fast pass.
Huh? Fast it's pass. A fast pass,
I
yeah.
Think you can know I'm a
they have the ability to actually track individuals as to where they are in the Russian River, how many times they've gone up and down, where are they going, and how they are behaving, in order to better figure out then where they can do some renovation of the places where they can nest, and to figure out how best to deal with making the salmon population grow.
And we're talking Chinook, Coho, and there's a couple other species too. There's several.
What's the other?
Steelhead. Sounds like good fishing to me.
So, if you ever get a chance to see it, definitely go. It's behind a security gate, so you need to be escorted.
Very cool.
But it's pretty cool. That's great. That's my report.
That was a great report you guys gave. I have nothing to add to that. It was really good.
It is a truly amazing organization.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Next up, agenda item 15, oral reports by commissioners, general manager. Any commissioners? Jason.
I didn't have a whole lot to mention to you all, so I didn't have a full report handout like I usually have. But what I was going to do, which I think maybe I'll postpone until next month, is I was going to give you kind of a brief presentation on a real successful rehabilitation project. But we have a light agenda next month, so maybe I'll just have that as a regular business item and a whole staff report explaining what it is, and I'll give you the presentation then.
Yeah, and if there were any particular employees that were involved in that, that would be great. It was really nice having Paul here tonight,
yeah.
I thought you guys would like that.
Yeah, that's
good.
Yeah. Okay, great. That's it.
That was it. Oh, I do have to comment on your one letter. If you didn't catch it, you've got to read the Washington Post article about the fat bird.
Oh, I did.
Oh, yeah.
That was in the front of that bird.
At least we don't have to deal with that. All right, next meeting is Tuesday, November 14th, 7 p.m. See you then. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you.
And, when is it convenient?